Before we start this episode, I would like to take a minute to tell you about the upcoming Texas Woodworking Festival, where makers and enthusiasts come together to celebrate their love for the craft. Join us for this two-day event filled with fun, creativity, and inspiration. The festival brings together lumberyards, woodworking organizations and clubs, content creators, furniture makers, and tool manufacturers for a weekend of food, drinks, and all things woodworking. This year, the festival is launching educational seminars where you'll have the opportunity to learn from some true masters of the craft, including Frank Straza, Philip Morley, Kim McIntyre, and Andrew Hunter, just to name a few. The festival will be held in Austin, Texas on August 26th and 27th. Visit TexasWoodworkingFestival.com for more information and to buy tickets. Whether you're a seasoned woodworker or just starting out, there's something for everyone at the Texas Woodworking Festival. Hi, and welcome to episode 447 of the MWA podcast. I'm Kyle, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Sean, Mark, and Brian. Today, we're excited to have Andy Rawls as our guest. Andy is a fine furniture maker and operates Andy Rawls Fine Texas Woodcraft, located in the beautiful Texas Hill Country. So welcome to the show, Andy.
Thanks, Kyle. Appreciate it, man. Excited to be here.
Yeah, we're kicking off our Texas Woodworking Festival. I guess we're having a bunch of exhibitors there, and Andy was kind enough to join us, and he's going to be there, and we're going to be talking a little bit with Andy and what he's going to be doing at the Texas Woodworking Festival, as well as what he's always up to, which is always interesting and exciting. There's cannons involved and stuff. So anyway, so stay tuned. But before we get to Andy, let's dip our toes into the woodworking news. So first off, John Joffrey, one of our guests a few episodes back, has come out with a twin beam mortise gauge. And it looks pretty interesting. He's now doing some pre-orders, and it's a pretty interesting thing. And it has twin beams, so it can mark two locations with one setting, and it's got a little thumb screw to secure each beam. And the price on it is $134.99 or $135. And it measures, the beams are about 8 inches long, and the actual block measures about 1.5 by 2¾ by a little over 1 inch. It also has some brass inlay on the lock. So this is, you know, going to be a very durable tool. So hats off to John for putting this out.
Yeah, it looks cool.
Absolutely. I mean, I find the pictures in shrubbery to be nice looking, but non-functional. It is a very nice shrub. Yeah. But I don't know that I've seen too many examples of a twin beam marking gauge. I know the concept where you've got two different layouts, essentially, you one for the one, and you only make the mistake maybe more than twice
when you, it's in the wrong
when you twist it the wrong way, but but that's a very nice tool.
It does look really well made.
I like the little thumb screws, or screws are wooden.
Those are not easy to make at that size. That's delicate work.
I think I was following along on his Instagram, and those are like cello.
Yeah, they look like cello tuners, right?
Eggs, and then he's cut threads into them. I'm not sure.
It amazes me how crisp the cuts are in the threads. I would think that it would tear out and look pretty bad.
He's using like a little jig that uses a V-bit on a router, and then an actual thread that drives the part. So it just you know, completely copies it, and it's just, you know, like Acme. What is that? A 30-degree angle or 60-degree angle cutter bit, but They look really sharp. I think the two pins are for like mortise, laying out mortises. So you would use the same reference face and lay out both edges of the mortise with one setup. And that's where it's not a big deal if you use the wrong side, because you're
right.
It's a pin style marking gauge for people. It's not a cutting.
And what is it? Is it Veritas that makes the wheel style dual beam?
I think
it's obviously metal, but same concept, but it's a wheel gauge instead of a scraping gauge.
And then there are some where there's just two knives on one block.
You'll just
there's a distance apart, like a quarter inch or whatever.
Right, so you always know that groove is going to be whatever.
Yeah.
Or, but yeah.
But it's going to be really good if you work with greenwood, this mm-hmm. types are really good in greenwood.
Yeah. And it looks like, I mean, it's gonna do well. The brass inlay as a kind of a wear plate on the writing surface mm-hmm. is a nice touch, because that's gonna be the part where it could get a little wonky with wear.
Yeah, pretty cool. And John, hats off to you.
Looks absolutely like
John. Excellent tool.
Yeah, well done, sir.
I'm sorry you won't be woodworking anymore.
Exactly. That's what happens when you get in the tool making business.
Yeah, ask Kyle working, what it's like to start making tools.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'll be working with wood, but you won't be doing any woodwork.
And speaking of woodworkers turning into tool makers, Clark Kellogg, a local woodworker here in the greater Houston area of Texas, has come out with this extra fancy depth gauge. And you can find this over at Heartwood Tools, Leslie's shop. She's selling them for them, and they're $80. And it's really interesting depth gauge. It can get into some really fine, intricate places. It is pretty cool looking depth gauge. Like I said, it's $80. It looks like it's made out of some brass and hardened steel, and it looks pretty cool. It's a real, you know, it's a real small depth gauge. I think it's the body's like 3/4 inch in diameter, and the rod is 3 inches long. So it's, you know, it's made for making fine depth
mm-hmm.
measurements.
But it's a very specific tool.
Yeah,
there.
Very specific.
Yes.
It has no numbers on it, to keep that in mind.
No, but it's good for like,
if you just need to make a consistent depth.
Yeah, I mean, it's good for practical. I mean, it's I don't need to stick to a drawing. I'm going to stick to what my tool did.
Yep. Exactly.
Especially when you're hand working and stuff like that. But I personally love the write-up. If you haven't, everybody go to Heartwood Tools and look up the extra-fancy depth gauge, because, yes, it could feed your cat and dog, sweep your floor, and do your taxes. But it may not do any of those things all at the same time.
Should have bought this a couple days ago.
Clark Kellogg had a great sense of humor, man.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
And
he's also super talented.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it's a very, very, like you said, like a very specific tool, very limited use tool, but probably a very precise tool all the same. So if it's what you're looking for, take a look. It's not a bad price point for the materials that are used in it, if the use case fits.
Yep.
Yeah. It's extra fancy.
Yeah.
In the name. It says it right there.
When I saw it, I said, I have no use for this tool, but boy, do I want one.
So, I feel like I would find a use, but I would also buy it. And this may be really stupid, but I'd buy it just because there's only 100 being made, and have a tool that Clark made. I mean, I don't know if he'll ever make a tool again. So it'd be kind of cool to have one of his tools.
A tool made of stainless steel and solid brass. It's not going to go bad anytime soon.
Yeah, I'll give it to my kids, right?
They for sure. You can go, what the hell is this trinket? Well, and, you know, this guy named Clark made it.
That's funny.
All righty. Well, moving right along, I just want to mention that a friend of the show, Wilbur Pan, is he's having an online class again with the Kurizaro K.
Kai.
Kazuro Kai.
Yeah. Thank you, Mark.
Yeah.
You were going to let me, you know, just stumble through that. I know.
Oh, yeah. Let your Texan voice.
At least the first one. Yeah.
Stumble on that.
Never stop you from pronouncing a word, like, ever.
Exactly.
It's quality radio. I mean, podcasting, whatever. It's good audio.
So, he is having a class, and it's an online class, and it's going to be May 21st. And you can go over there to kazurokai.us. And as I mentioned before in our, when we're posting these episodes, we are including the links to this. So if you need a link to this, feel free to look at that. But it's kazurokai.us, and just hit their classes and sign up there. But the classics grades, Introduction to Japanese Saws, and knowing Wilbur, it's going to be absolutely fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was many years ago at some conference, I saw Wilbur present Western Tools, mm-hmm. and he brought his whaleback saw, or whatever that thing's called, that huge.
Oh, the huge one. Yeah.
And it he's a very good speaker, and I know he's done a lot of online classes, and so this is another one in the list. Mm-hmm. What is it, 75 for non-members, 60 for members, and you can get on newsletter to get the discount for $15. Probably not going to kill you if you're interested in that kind of thing. Sign up for the newsletter, save yourself some money, and learn from one of the best, for sure. Wilbur's a great teacher, for sure.
Exactly.
this one's going in my newsletter of the week for sure.
There you go. Yeah,
there you go.
Just, I mean, it is interesting. I mean, when I sat through his class, however long ago that was, you know, the Western thinking, you know, the fact that, you know, we did things different times, different parts of the world, but the whole idea of how you support things when you pull and the sawtooth go the different way, like it is, it's, there's a lot of history in it. I don't know how much he might delve into that, but I think he will. It's very, very interesting from a historic sense and just a tool working sense, mm-hmm. how those things operate in comparison to what the Craftsman store was selling you for decades.
Yep, exactly. And he's excellent at doing that, and especially giving you some of the, you know, little, I guess, intricacies and some of the particular things about the Japanese saws. Like no one thing he taught me was because I use Japanese saws in a couple of things that I do, and I was having some problems with things not straying on the line, and he goes, are you using one hand or two hands? I said one hand. He goes, use two hands, that saw. Mm-hmm. You know,
interesting. Yeah. It's so wild to think that. I mean, like, yep. you don't think of that with a Western saw or an Eastern saw, I should say. Mm-hmm. But this thing with just a kind of a stick handle.
Yep.
It is more stable when you have two hands on it. If you have one, you're going to impart some twist and it's going to fight you. Mm.
Yep.
I have very little experience with Japanese saws, but the guy who works for me, who I hired my apprentice, he showed up with one and I was like, I can't use that. Like it's hard. It's, I don't know. It's just different.
It's different. It's like riding a bike backwards. I mean, it really is. You're used to pushing with that arm, and now you're pulling instead. And totally so your hold fast, your support, you know, none of it works. Yeah. But once you figure that out, and if you do, I mean, Kyle, if you use them, you know, like it's in my experience, and very, very limited, it's a gentler approach. You're not trying to just manhandle, white knuckle grip this thing and hammer through it. You know, it's a finesse to the work, but
it's a much more delicate tool.
It too, is.
Right? I mean, it's a thinner.
The curve is smaller.
It's a thinner curve. Curve. And you know, if you're off real quick, because it starts banging around and you know, you'll, the ones without backs, especially. But you know, you're, it's just a different thinking, and you know, it works for some, works for not others, but you know, it's just good to have that information out there. Cause sometimes you may find the way that's necessary, maybe, and they're inexpensive too, which is great. Most, commonly available, at least. You know,
yeah. The ones with the "quote unquote" disposable blades, they're
relatively. Yeah, I mean, you can go to Lowe's and get a really cheap one, you know, but it gets you into that, and the second you try to push with it, you're going to go, "What the hell?" You know, like this isn't working. But no, it's like slowly, gently draw it backwards, and it'll do the work. It really will.
Can you resharpen them? That's my only question. Like
not the mass manufactured ones. I think they're using the impulse hardened teeth. Of course, I think I have heard about people sharpening them. Wilbur could probably ask
the angles are really acute.
Yeah.
Really, really acute.
Normal saw file is not going to work. So
yeah, I was going
to
say
you'd have to have a specialty saw.
Yeah.
You'd have to have something because the teeth are very, the TPI is very short and the depth is greater. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so to get that full cutting, you know, you're going to have something fairly specific to sharpen it.
Yeah. But there are, you know, like saw masters that make saws and, you know, in Japan, and, you know, you can pay whatever you want to pay for
it. Of course. Of course.
So, but yeah.
Better make good breakfast.
Yeah, exactly. The more affordable ones, they work great. And that's what I like. I like the real small curve. And it's really handy, especially for sawing off chair legs.
Because
I like to saw them off where I have the chair, you know, on a bench, and I can run the saw parallel to the bench and get a straight cut across. Without having to do a compound angle if I'm, you know, have the chair.
A lot of them, side or something. All of them are like a flush cut kind of saw where you can push right up against something.
They'll flex so much that you can actually bend the blade onto the flat of the table too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you can be above the table and cut at the table.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Or if you're like cutting the top of a leg off in a saddled seat, you can actually hold it in a curve and then move it in an arc.
Yeah.
And it'll cut. You know, it'll cut a big chunk of material off, and then you come back and gouge
it down. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe I should give it a second shot.
Yeah.
It's worth a try. It depends. I think it depends on what you started out learning. And if you start out learning Western saws, it's going to be kind of interesting.
Yeah, I don't doubt for a minute that they're useful, because Japanese furniture makers are, a lot of them are on another level. So
yeah,
it's what you're used to using, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Well, moving on, another friend of the show, Emmett Van Drish, if I'm pronouncing that right, Drish, I think I should say.
Drish.
I don't know. I'm guessing. Anyway, Emmett, he was on probably about a year ago, and he's a very, very talented spoon carver, but he has a new book called The Greenwood Spoon Carver. So that is out, and you can pick that up over at his spoonosaurus.com website. And like I said, we'll have some links there. We'll also have a direct link to Blurb, which is selling the book for him. Now, I will tell you, it is a bit expensive, but it is a 396 page book that has everything that he knows about spoon carving. So the price is $275.70. So be prepared, but it looks like a fantastic book. And if you want to get into spoon carving, I think this would be your quote unquote Bible of spoon carving.
It seems like a Bible or a fun book. That's a thick book.
That's a lot.
So no doubt. And I mean, he's a great teacher. So I'm only assuming that's going to be, a well appointed book. You know, it's got pictorial and instructional content inside it for sure.
I'm amazed that you can amass 396 pages on spoon carving.
It must go to every possible single thing, detail.
Oh, there's cool. I'm sure there's a lot like really beautiful photographs in there as well.
Yeah, well, just look at the preview now.
So I would say, you know, if you're concerned about price, first learn everything he knows about spoon carving and then write a book.
Exactly.
I don't think it's unfair at all. and you might understand, like, pay an editor, book designer, all those people.
And
you might understand why it costs what it costs.
When I did log on to the Blurb website, about a minute after I logged on, one of those pop-ups came, 20% off your first book order. So that might make it a little more palatable.
And I think he does have some project books out there that are a little less expensive, but they, like I said, they're project type books. It's not the the distillation of everything he knows about spoon carving. But so if you're looking for something a little bit more budget friendly, you might check that out. But he's a very, very talented spoon carver. So check that out if you're into it.
I mean, talking about the number of pages and looking into the table of contents, there are 36 pages of wood before core and tools. Tools last from 82 to 136. So you've got some 54 pages of tools. That has to be every example, it's everything. Absolutely. Super in depth for sure.
Man, he touched on, like, there's a chapter on mental. That sounds really intriguing to me. The headspace of where you need to be.
We talked to him. He is a very, very talented and thoughtful, person.
This is cool.
That's going to be very, very good.
Sorry, Mark, you had some?
No, I was just going to say that I agree.
You're here.
I stopped to listen and forgot what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Emmett, he thinks a lot about making a lot of spoons. So he's developed all kinds of ergonomic practices, and that, that also goes into the mental preparedness. Making 100 spoons in a month. All the same, it kind of really helps you distill down the process and clarify what's
important. Oh, for sure.
This is not a fake it till you make it book. This guy knows spoon carving is not, and I think he understands what it's like. He's one of these people that is really good, but also understands what it's like for a new person to learn.
And he also has an almost daily podcast he puts out. It's, you know,
did he cool. miss some days? He's, it seems like he's always there.
Yeah, yeah, but it, yeah, it's only, you know, it's like 10 minutes or so like that. But you know, just mm-hmm. like, hey, what's he doing today? Where's his mind at? You know, what's going on? And
that's pretty
what's
neat.
He working on? So yeah, it's pretty neat, pretty neat. And woodworking news would not be complete without a stopover at Woodpeckers. So Woodpeckers has a new tool out called the Sandstand Tilting Sander Base. It's kind of interesting. It's like one of those.
You got one on order.
Hmm?
You've already got you? One on order, right?
Yeah, yeah. Not yet, not yet. But basically what it does is it takes your palm sander and turns it into a stationary sander as state, but it's a little device that you can hold your sander in, and then it keeps it fixed, and you can have it flat on your bench, or you know, basically upside down on your bench, or you can move it to a certain angle to where it is horizontal to your bench. So it's pretty interesting little thing. It's one of those things that if you use your sander like this, you're going to want one. Now with me, I deal with a lot of small parts. So I actually do put my palm sander into like a hand screw and put that, you know, so the palm sander's upside down on my mm-hmm. use it to, you know, sand some small parts. And so this is something when I saw it, I went, pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you have a 5 or a 6 inch sander?
Both. But for the small parts, I mainly use the 5 inch though.
I would just think for this, like I need to, because you're making it a service to use, the yeah. bigger service might be more beneficial just so you're not, you don't have yeah. trouble seeing whatever you're putting on it, you know, because that's a pretty yeah. small space. And in, if it's an orbital sander, getting used to contacting that, and you may be, Kyle, I mean, it's,
yeah.
but like, there's a lot of vibration. There's a lot
that's
of
what I'm thinking. Yeah,
movement like, to, yeah. to upturning that and seeing it happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's put it this way. I would not say this is a substitute for a disc sander or anything like that.
Yeah. Well, that's that, it. I mean, yeah. this or I don't know yeah. how much they are to get like a Ryobi thing from the big box store.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, that does kind of this operation. Thing. Yeah, a little combo belt disc kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, mind you, my Festool sander is very, very, very nice, and it may produce a much better quality, you know, sand. Mm-hmm. But
dust collections.
And dust collection is going to be much better. Absolutely. Okay. So, I mean, there's absolutely kind of pros and cons. I'd be interested if people start getting this and like see a comparison. It looks like a simple thing. It's not red, which is anti-woodpeckers, but not predominantly red, at least. But
it's some red.
It's also not aluminum, as far as I can tell. So that's kind of
like it's powder coated.
The less red it has on it, the less expensive. Like that's the one thing about
true
this.
Story.
It's not outrageously expensive. $80.
Yep. Look at this thing. This thing's that's like half the size of a shoebox, and it's less than $100 from Woodpeckers. That's a win.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it really yep. isn't. I mean, Kyle, like you said, like if this is something you do, and you're doing small pieces, and you yep. use your existing sanders, and you don't have a combo yep. or you know dedicated disc or belt sander yep. or what I've done in not a orbital, but I've clamped a belt sander down and used that mm-hmm. you yeah. know I mean I don't know, that's fairly common, but this operating, you know, maybe it's a little more secure, again, better mm-hmm. dust collection on those kind of sanders. I mean, it's not bad for under $100.
Yeah. Well, there's like, I have my sander finder, and part of the sander finder is this little piece of wood that's kind of got wide chamfers on three sides.
Mm-hmm.
And the front side of this is all ingrained. So I got to sand that. And the best way I've found to sand that is to turn my palm sander upside down mm-hmm. and, you know, just stick that 45 degree angle on that palm sander, trying to, put that like on a belt sander, or you know, I have the rigid one with the belt and the spindle sander and all that kind of that mm-hmm, combo machine. Mm-hmm. It's almost impossible to put that on there and not, you know, totally burn the wood. You know, this makes a use case for me, but I'm probably pretty rare, but I don't know. I mean, you know, obviously there's yeah. some demand out there for it. They wouldn't have come up.
It almost looks like if you get this, you are going to relegate that sander to this operation. And if you want it for anything else, you're going to get another sander. you know, you're locking this one in, and it doesn't look incredibly convenient to get back out. Uh-huh. It's going to be securely attached and doing its thing, and that's fantastic. But you know, if you Festool stopped selling their cheap one years ago, I got one when they did, but
well, those are the two I have. I have the 6-inch and the 5-inch of the cheaper Festool line, not the new ones. Yeah.
Yep. I've got the 5, and it's I mean, it's a great, I mean, honestly, a great offering from Woodpeckers. I mean, that's approachable, not terribly overpriced. And with some jigging, as they even show, like, oh, you want to make this 90 degree, you build a box in front of it and make it a 90 degree surface. Or just make it ergonomically fit for your height or whatever, you know, when you're working with what you're doing, you can set it to whatever you want. If you're just doing something that just sits on top of the sander.
Yep. Well, like I said, it's, you know, it fits a use case that I have, and I'm not sure how many people have that, but you know, it looks interesting for me. There's a couple of people out there. I know one specifically that has a competing product, but it just basically secures your sander upside down, and it's almost as expensive as this. So
there you go.
Yeah, I thought, interesting. But you know, right now, I mean, this doesn't come out till June. I got plenty of time to think about it, and you know, and it looks a little bit more convenient than trying to secure this in a hand screw, but you know,
it looks like you can mount it to the wall too.
That's what I was just looking at that. I was like, I like that wall mount option. You put that and a 6-inch sander, and now you're just walking up and doing Kyle, your operation you're just talking about, just kissing the end grain chamfer, and you can do it at like waist height against the wall and just go and done. I mean, it is like the Jimmy DiResta 15-inch disc sander at that point. Like you know, that's all. If that's what you need and that's what your main use is, boom. I mean, that's not a bad price for getting something to just kind of outfit you for an easier operation.
Yeah, I'll probably pick one up, but I will not pick it up till it's off the I guess what it is, the early ordering option.
Yeah, it's like,
let's see, because it's like 80 bucks now
and 100 bucks later.
I'll probably get it when it's 100 bucks, because the thing I found out about Woodpeckers is the shipping is just outrageous. If you go in there and order something, like this happened to me a couple of months ago. I wanted something that they just came out that they weren't shipping yet, but I wanted something that they had in stock. Well, I ended up having to pay 2 shippings.
No bueno.
Yeah, and I went, no, I don't think so. I'll wait till y'all have this in stock, and then I'll order both. Even if I've got to pay another, you know, 15 bucks more, it's worth it as far as shipping goes.
Yeah, and I kicked myself because we got our butts whipped in a lacrosse game against the local team from where they are. Mm-hmm. You know, I saw the thing the other day, and they're like, made proudly in Strongsville, Ohio. And I'm like, those bastards beat us by like 12, you know, like, but, like it is in reach of me. I mean, if it comes down to it, I might be able to save you shipping by going and picking something up. Should it come to it, let me know.
Hey, that might be a good idea. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's a benefit of being where near where they are. They're within 2 hours of me.
Yeah. Cause I could just send you a shipping label. Cause I
and say, shipping. Can you choose that when ordering? Will pick up at manufacturing facility?
I don't know. I'm going to try it out.
Yeah, let me know, and I'll make the drive.
Yeah. Well, you may have to ship everything back in a crate. Okay.
Oh, but Jesus.
Right, I got a freight account with YRC. So
yeah, so much red anodized aluminum going to Texas. This oh, boy.
Exactly. Well, moving on, let's move on to our Patreon shout out. So who do we have to thank this?
Yeah, you know, we always like to give a big shout out to our Patreon supporters. Today, we're going to give that shout out to our friend and chef of the show, Anthony Moraes. Thank you for supporting us, sir. And if you would like to support the MWA podcast like Chef Moraes, go to patreon.com/MWA podcast.
Yes. Thanks so much. Chef.
I don't know. Is that like doctor? Do they prefer seeing that? I mean, we know him as that, but
well, he's a corporate chef, right?
He is a corporate chef. Yeah, so I would think that's like the
meta chef,
a name of distinction, you know, where you.
Yeah.
You,
yeah. I guess he was a Facebook chef, corporate chef. So I guess now he's a meta.
Now he's meta. Yeah.
Well, it could still be Facebook, but
Does he put his dinky to his lips and say, I didn't go to chef school for 6 years to be, you know, not called
a chef. Don't diminish me. Let us know, man. Anthony, write us. We need to know.
Please.
Exactly. Well, let's move on to what's in the shop. So, Mark, what are you working on?
Oh, gosh. I'm working on putting together a prototype mudroom bench. I'm working with the Amana Furniture Company up in Iowa, where Handworks is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to put together a little 4-day class that's meant to be like an introduction to post and rung construction. And so I need something that I can photograph to give people an idea of what we're building. So that's my big goal this week, is to get that together and get the seat woven. We're doing a flat reed seat on it. Cool. And hopefully have that class up for sale in the next couple of weeks so that people can go.
That's exciting.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It'd be fun.
So is that going to be before Handworks or after?
It'll be the Sunday through Wednesday after Handworks. So Handworks ends on Saturday evening.
Mm-hmm.
We'll start the first day of class actually in the furniture company, because they'll be closed on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second, third, and fourth day, we'll be moving to a different building just because the employees will be back and they'll be making more noise. So, and the room that we're moving to is going to be sort of like a, I don't know, like a logistical area for the after Handworks, mm-hmm. you know, things that need to be moved in and out. So it'll be a little too noisy and distracting on that first day. But you're going to spend a couple days shaping all the parts by hand, and another day drilling and assembling. And then we'll weave the seat on the fourth day.
Cool. So, what kind of material are you going to weave with?
We're going to use a flat reed. So it's a split reed. It's like a 5/8 width. We have two different colors. There's a natural color, which is like a creamy white color. It's a really, really clean looking material. And then we have smoked, which is, it's the best replacement. Well, it's the best looking replacement for hickory bark. And you know, if you've tried to get hickory bark in the last 2 years, you know, it's getting challenging, mm-hmm. Especially like high quality hickory bark. So I've been trying to offer something that's a little easier to get, and use that as a baseline for people, because, well, in the chair classes that we're working on, you know, if you're going to build 8 chairs or 6 chairs for your house, you don't want to have to like cut a seat out because you can't find hickory bark somewhere and you want them all to match.
Yeah.
So we're going with something that's a little easier to find, you know, more regularly. So yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm, you know, we're still ironing out the details, but looking at maybe having 8 students. And it's a really simple tool set. You know, it's basically marking and measuring tools and a draw knife and a spoke shave.
That's fun, man.
So,
yeah. Is that in conjunction with the you know, Jamil and the guys, or?
So what I'm trying to do is make sure that we're not interfering with the show at all. And so, okay. And also, I mean, I'm going to be at the show, so I don't want to teach during the show. That's too much fun to miss. So, yeah. So, you know, I contacted them and I said, hey, is there a place where I could have a class? And it just turns out that the guy that's running the Amana Furniture Company is interested in hosting classes up there. So,
oh, awesome.
So we're working together we're going to get like a discount rate in the hotel for the class, the days of the class, mm-hmm. for the students, you know, try to get a little, you know, save you some money there for those days. It doesn't work during the Handworks show, but you know, for people who are adding on a few days, they can get a new reservation. And he's really excited to do some teaching, you know, to have some people teaching up there. So hopefully this starts something. You know, I feel like it's a really big opportunity to have all these hand tool enthusiasts in one place and not have a class that they can take. You know, like it's something that I've wanted to do for a while, but I just, like, a workbench class in Iowa is it's a tough thing to pull off.
Sure.
Yeah.
And so with the chair making, this is a little bit different. So, you know, maybe we'll do this year. And if it goes well, maybe we'll find, you know, one or two other people. I don't know how much room there is. I've got to go up there in the next month or so to figure out the logistics of the class and the space, but we're going to figure it out one way or the other. So
are you getting shave horses for everyone?
I'm going to have four. I will have four shave horses, definitely.
Okay.
I'm going to, so I'm basically going to, the class is going to be either 750 or 800. So there'll be four spots with shave horses, and those will be 800, and there'll be four spots at workbenches, and those will be 750. So you basically choose, well, based on what's available, you know, and in a perfect world, I will have, I'll offer a $50 discount to anyone who brings their own shave horse.
What if I buy one from you to bring it?
If you you can do that. I will give you a, I will work a deal. Actually going to be starting a few shave horses here in a few weeks, but, and I'll have a few extras, but yeah, if you want to order a horse and take delivery at the show,
cool.
Yeah, we'll work something out, but yeah, it's like eight shave horses, like here in my shop, which is where I'll be teaching 99.9% of the time. Eight shave horses is, you know, that's a lot of space.
Yeah.
And so I could probably manage it. I don't know where I'd put them the other 300 days of the year.
Yeah.
Well,
I need to mention that, you know, BB Custom Tools has a new service for renting shave horses.
Yeah.
Be up on our website.
I'll rent post. A few. Mark, I don't know if you knew this, but I did a brief apprenticeship with Brian Boggs. So I got a chance. This was like 2003, but I got a chance to cut hickory bark with him and learn how to make chairs. So it's been a long time since I've made them, but man, I miss that. Chair making is so much fun.
Mm.
It is. You know, you sell, and we'll get to this, but you know, you make a lot of tables. You got to have some chairs to go with it.
Dude, it's like generally when someone asks for chairs, I'm telling them it's going to be more than the table. But what I need to do is design a line to have that I already know how to make. You know,
I agree with you. Chair making is it's hard to stop once you've started.
Yeah,
I agree.
And you know, we're doing all this work with joint effort, and I feel bad because there's just so much chair making stuff in there right now, and I want it to be more all encompassing, but you know, it's just me, you know, so for until I get these classes out of the pipeline, it's really hard to do a good job with that and, you know, do a bunch of other things in time.
I understand.
I don't know, maybe it'll just end up being like a chair cult. I don't know.
It kind of already is, but anyway.
Yeah.
Enough about me. What's Brian working on?
So I'm finally making some progress in the garden renovation. I got two out of the three tiers in, plumbed in. All the old garden beds are gone. All the old wood a local woodworker took to heat his shop. He was over the moon because he's like, that's like 2 years of heat for him, the amount of wood that he took. And he actually found some nice quarter sawn white oak boards that were still underneath the deck that hadn't been exposed to the weather yet. So it helped me tremendously because it was a 7 foot tall stack of white oak that it was partially rotted. And so he did me a favor by taking all of it. But the new garden looks great. Thank God I have a tractor because it's a lot of dirt. But we're trying to use everything that we've taken down. We took down some pine trees, 7 pine trees last fall. So I'm using this cut up trunks on the bottom and then the chipped up branches on top. And then, you know, two thirds of worth of soil in each bed. So it's coming along nicely. My wife's kind of yelling at me because you guys can't see this obviously, but about 4 feet to my right is all the seedlings that have been started. And she says these beds have to be in. And by the time these are ready to go outside. So in my portion of Pennsylvania, usually your last frost is around Mother's Day. Mm-hmm. So I don't have too much time left to get these other beds in. So
timer's ticking.
I've seen your seed starter set up from a few years ago. You've probably got like 1,000 seeds going.
It's quite a bit. My neighbors always ask me if I'm growing pot because there's all these, it's this huge rack of things. There's full spectrum LEDs everywhere. And it all breaks down and disappears, which is nice, but it's quite the operation.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll be happy when that's done. And then I'm going to have to bring in even more dirt for the floor of the garden. I lost the battle with the weeds last year. I'm just going to grass it over and then mow it. So it'll be one less thing to deal with. But, so that's the big outdoor thing. Yeah. And I know everybody gets tired of talking about field hockey on a woodworking podcast, but that garden, the turf project is completely done. Mm. Everybody that walks in there is like, whoa, it's over the top. But
how many teammates are coming over to say, hey, can we practice here?
Well, you know, it's funny because that word's starting to get out with her teammates, and they're like, mm-hmm. you know, we're coming over there if it's raining because I don't want to play. You know, they want to practice outside. So,
Wait.
Do they play in the rain?
Oh, yeah. Rain, snow.
Get sleep. Back out there. Practice in the rain. You're never going to be any good in the rain. You're going to practice in the rain.
Everything but lightning. So,
yep.
Yeah. There you go.
But there was a tragedy. You know, an outdoor field hockey goal is pretty much universal across all the countries. So they're about 12 feet wide, 7 feet high, about 4 feet deep. So I had a net pre-made to fit those dimensions, and I tried to make it out of wood, but the posts are only 2 inches wide and regulation size, and you know, not even maybe two and a half inches deep. And when I had this assembled, it racked so much, and it would just totally disintegrate just from the impact of shots.
Ooh, man.
So I was like, oh, you gotta be kidding me. So I'm like, I'm gonna have to commission somebody to make one out of aluminum for me or steel. Probably mm-hmm. Just to use the net that I have already, but I had a portable net here already. So we popped that up, and I took the wooden one out and admitted defeat and just cut it up. But it was so simple. It's just two big rectangles connected by a couple cross beams. I'm like, how hard can this be? And
right.
It every time they would hit it, it would just jerk back. The wood would just flying off of it. So, and it was just racking left and right. So now I realize why there aren't wooden field hockey goals. So
yeah,
if you're thinking about it, don't try that.
Well, can you repurpose one of the outdoor field hockey goals to be used inside?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
Okay. That's the thing. Like those things are bigger than what I deal with lacrosse. So I'm sure they're harder.
Twice, twice the size. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if you buy a commercial field hockey goal, it's about $3,000.
Ooh, yeah.
So
yeah.
I'd be without my own
plus shipping. Yeah. So yeah. I think locally, I'm just going to find somebody who's a fabricator and make me an aluminum cage, and I'll powder coat it and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's funny because like the door that goes into my house from my garage is about 5 feet left of the goal. And I padded the walls left, right, and above the goal so she could take full shots.
Mm-hmm.
And within 2 days, there's dents in that door. So I'm thinking, oh man, you're killing me.
Something I used to, and I don't know the dimensions for the field hockey, but the dimensions for boys lacrosse and girls lacrosse, frankly, outdoor is 6x6. And so I used to tell my sixth grade kids that I coached, and on to seventh and eighth grade too. And you know, I still rib the kids in high school. I'm like, guys, 36 square feet of goal. Hit that. Stop missing. Like it's a huge space. Figure out what it takes to get inside that space.
Yep, exactly.
Small targets make goals.
Yep. Yeah, I want to get this garden done, so it's time to move on to some cabinetry work inside the house. That's what we're doing. Sean, how about you?
Nothing exciting like that, other than the lacrosse I was just talking about. Plenty of that going on. I will say, on a personal note, I had an opportunity. This is so strange and definitely not woodworking related, but I gotta tell the tale. My wife had samples from her work of a continuous glucose monitor, and I wore one, and it lasted 2 weeks, and it was very interesting. Found out I shouldn't get cookies at Subway. Who knew? Ah, that's terrible for you. Don't get the Happy Meal, kids. Like, it's not good for you. But it was a very eye-opening thing to improve my health, to find out how I react to things. I will say that an apple spiked more than a cookie. So
interesting.
I'll stay away from apples.
For a shorter period of time? Or
that's weird.
No, and actually, I mean, so you get into continuous glucose monitoring, you see these like gradient. It's not a finger prick of a diabetic. I'm not diabetic, you know, so these are things that are useful for diabetics, more like scientific for me. Yeah. But you get to see how steep is that spike and how far does it fall when it's done, mm-hmm. if that's the only thing you take in kind of like a duration. It was a steeper spike with a red delicious, I think it was apple from Panera. I got a salad and an apple side,
super,
you know, sweet. And it's very sweet apple. And so my body reacts to that in a kind of alarming way. And it dipped really low when it was done. you know, and that's
well, it's a little known fact that Panera Bread's apples are injected with, you know.
Oh, Jesus. No, but
it's corn syrup, you know.
No, I know. There's good science behind this, and it's hard. And Brian, I'm sure you're going to say something, but like there's different ways that everybody deals with it. And so like my wife found out that a cookie, and I keep coming back to cookie, but like she had a cookie at one point and saw her spike. She wore one too. And then she had this really, really healthy flaxseed oatmeal combo thing. And that oatmeal did her damage, spiked her almost 200 in her glucose, mm-hmm. where something like a sweet treat did not. And so it's like, oh, I'm going to stay away from oatmeal. And as a general term, because that's just an unhealthy spike. And when you come down from the spike is the dangerous bit too, you know, and you know, all this other stuff. And then from a half marathon training, which I'm currently doing, seeing how after my long runs on the weekend, how hypoglycemic I went for duration, mm-hmm. you know, when, especially when I was sleeping, that was very interesting as well. Like it was an informing thing.
How does it work? How does it like monitor you?
It's a arm thing. So you like clean a spot on your arm. I put it behind my tricep and it just pokes in, and it's like a flexible injection that wow. sits there, and it's Bluetooth to your phone on an app.
That's crazy.
And so it alarms when you are too low or too high, and you can set the parameters, you know, and for somebody with health risks with, you know, anything, you know, that's very important. I was talking to a coworker who is type 2 diabetic, and he does finger pricks 3 times a day. You know, before mm-hmm. meals, this takes away that, and also gives you better information that it's not a point in time. You see the scale, you see the arc, you know, you see how you react. You see when you fall, you see what you are when you're feeling low, you're feeling high, whatever, you know, like all things. It's crazy.
Allows you to be proactive versus reactive.
Yeah. Very, very. Yeah. And for me, I mean, and I said, like, I'm a bad patient in general. Like I don't seek, you know, medical, you know, counsel commonly. But if you told me I was diabetic, you bet your ass I'd be a vegetarian in like a heartbeat, you know, cause like, and then smartly too, cause I wouldn't, you know, and I've seen other people do this where they've tested. They're like, they'll get a continuous glucose and then they'll fast and take 100 calories of green peppers and 100 calories of rice and brown rice and you know, white rice and brown rice, and like figure out what works for them. Because the truth is, in the grand scheme of things, for some people a chocolate chip cookie is better than an apple, and some people a banana is the worst thing in the world. You know, everyone metabolizes differently and uses it differently.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, there's your body doesn't break down, every sugar kind of breaks down slightly differently.
Right. You
know, there's more complex sugars, and then some people have, this is, you know, kind of the weeds here, but the people have an overshoot of insulin production to match that sugar, and they kind of overshoot. So that's why you become hypoglycemic at times. So, you know, eating more complex carbohydrate type things, that's why, you know, marathon runners are eating pasta, you know, steel cut oats versus regular cut oats, you know, all that.
Oh, and so, see, that's another one I'd like to try.
Yeah.
Like,
so it gets really complex. It is.
And so I was trying to find information on, because I went on a long run. I went, you know, a 14-mile run, and my normal breakfast is 2 egg whites and 1 egg, pan fried, like lightly in olive oil. So it's like 200 calories, but high in protein. And I went and ran, and an hour and a half later, my glucose went up, like was rising up to like 110. Not anything alarming, but it was rising. And I'm like, I'm depleted at this point. I haven't had carbs in 15 hours plus, you know. But what was interesting in that, it didn't like fall sharply. The next weekend, in the time that I had this thing, instead of having eggs, I had waffles. Oh, it spiked real quick, but then it leveled out, you know? And so at some point, like as a distance runner, I want to see, as a fitness thing, I want to see like convert my fat stores into energy, please, you know, as I'm going along. That would benefit me personally, but it's just a very interesting thing. So should you have the need or find the capacity to find one, like my wife who has spare samples in her office to get a continuous glucose monitor, it's a very interesting thing to kind of inform yourself on what you consume and how your body reacts to it. It's wild. Yeah. Very, very off that. But anyway, and also before the show, I mentioned it, but we're in spring in the Midwest. And so with all my lacrosse activities with my kids, I have a sunburn and it snowed within 3 days. It's very interesting to you all see. We were at a game yesterday. I was in three layers and I had a face mask because the wind was dead in my face. And tomorrow it's supposed to be 84. So here we are. It's spring. If I get out without being sick, I'm fine. I have a race on the weekend. I'd rather not be. Kyle, what's in your shop?
Actually, there's a lot going on in the shop, but right now just the normal stuff, just, you know, cranking out orders and getting stuff done. I have right now, I think I made a post this morning. I got two seat drilling guides that are not spoken for. So get on those if you want one.
Hop on it.
Exactly. I am out of drill bits at this point in time, but hopefully I'll get some more making drill bits in. I should get some in next week, so I'll be stocked back up with drill bits. So that's really been about it. One of the interesting things that we did do this weekend, my wife and I, is we're starting a new thing where we're going to Galveston and to the kind of historic district where they have a bunch of nice homes and stuff like that that were built, oh, I would say mid to late 1800s to early 1900s. Wow. And we're just taking a street and walking down it. Because you can drive down these streets all day long, you miss so much detail. And if you walk on and stuff like that. So you might see some of those on my Instagram feed in the next few days.
How much of Galveston, Kyle, do you think? Galveston's gotten like two or three major hurricanes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's amazing that there's...
What has survived?
Right. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, 1900 was the big one, right. The great storm where somewhere between 6 and 20,000 people died. No one's really sure. But it's the biggest natural disaster in the U.S. At that point. At that point in time, they raised the whole island by about 6 to 9 feet, depending on where you were in the area. So all the houses got lifted up and raised up and all of that. And a lot of them survived, and especially the area we were had a lot of surviving houses. Those that were closer to the actual beach did not quite survive so well. And then we actually had Hurricane Ike back in 2008. And that the water actually rose higher than it did during the 1900 storm. The wind wasn't nearly as bad. It was just a category.
It's the storm surge.
Yeah, it's just a category 2 storm, but it was about as big as a category 5 hurricane. So it was huge hurricane. And but that put a lot of water into the island. But like I said, almost everybody rebuilt afterwards, you know, did all that kind of stuff. And so there are still a lot of surviving homes. And, you know, a lot of Victorian homes, it's probably one of the best cities in Texas. If you want to see Victorian homes, come to Galveston. There's a ton of them. And part of the reason because of that is because the Houston Ships Channel, when it came in the 1920s and 30s, basically all of the ship traffic that was coming into the port of Galveston went into the port of Houston. And Galveston kind of died. You know, population went down. You know, nothing was being built. So, you know, it's kind of bad for the city of Galveston, but it preserved those houses because they weren't torn down and rebuilt and stuff like that. So, yeah.
I was just sitting here thinking what it must have been like to be hanging on your front porch in the 1900s, not knowing that a hurricane is about to destroy.
Or ask Kyle
okay, this looks pretty bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They did have some warning a little bit, but a lot of the forecasters at that point in time didn't think it was going to be that big a deal, but there were some forecasters that were actually
there was a little bit of
some people in I think out of Cuba that kind of doing some warning, said this is going to be a big one, but it never got here, you know. And you know, like all hurricanes, the day before it was just a beautiful day.
ask Kyle about a floating joiner and how that works out in the end, because sucks.
I was just getting into woodworking and kind of upgrading all my entry level machines when Hurricane Ike hit. So it put 6 feet of water in my shop. So
dang it.
Yeah. So
yeah, I've been to Kyle's. He's on an inlet, or and what do you call that? you know,
on a canal.
Okay, it's a canal off the Gulf.
Oh,
of Mexico.
You're on a canal. Okay.
So
Yeah.
Water is his backyard, and
I bet there's not too many wood shops down there in those houses on the canals.
Probably not.
No. I think there's one other besides me. There used to be one other.
They're all built on stilts. It's just what's built underneath the stilt, you know, and that's what it is.
It
was shocking. I mean, I was there after that happened, but I knew that it had happened in the past. And I mean, the shop right now is in perfect condition, but by God, if it happens again,
I've had to move my machinery out a few times, and you know, just to be on the safe side.
Yeah,
because I don't want that to happen again. Because now I have really expensive machinery. Yeah. At that point in time, you know, I had like a job site table saw. You know, the normal stuff people get started with. Yeah,
but save the woodpeckers.
It's aluminum. It'll be fine.
It doesn't float away.
It's fine.
Exactly. Well, speaking of that, so Andy, what are you working on in your shop?
Yeah, I've got two pieces that are done, ready to be picked up, delivered. One of which is a display case that I make that holds 120 golf balls. Somehow through the magic of the internet, I've become a display case maker. I've shipped these things all over Australia, Dubai.
Wow.
There's a guy in Australia. He's bought three from me. And his goal, he's retired, is to play the top 100 courses in Australia, then come to America and play the top 100 courses. So he bought these cases to display all the balls. So we just finished up one of those, and then I have a dining table that I sell off my website, a catalog table. I call it the Seguin Farmhouse Table. It's out of Cherry. Guys coming to pick that up next week. And then we started two new projects this week, one of which is a custom sofa. So this is the first sofa I've ever built. I'm really excited about it, and I got to fully design this myself, and that's going to Taos, New Mexico. It'll have leather seats, so there's some upholstery to it. It's made out of walnut. And it's, we were talking with Mark before we started the show earlier, it's turned post. So it has the same kind of, it's not similar to Ladderback. It has more of a Danish modern style, but the construction kind of draws me back to Ladderback because I'm figuring out how to cut joints and round parts. So it's a lot of fun. So I've actually spent probably 2 days just with two pieces of test poplar cutting mortises in it and figuring it all out. So I'm about ready to start actually working in the walnut. And then we have a king bed that we just started. That's fairly basic. It'll have a veneered headboard and veneered footboard. And then I've got a really cool dining table that we're finishing it up right now. It's actually from my wife's uncle, and it's made out of, I've ordered Rift Sawn red oak that was pre-fumed. So the coloring was pre-fumed in the veneers. These are veneers. I don't know if I said that. So we laid up these veneers, and then we banded it with red oak, and then I fumed the banding to match the veneer. And then this table is going to sit on it's really hard to explain, but it's like an 18 by 18 stone pedestal base, 18 inches. So it's a small footprint for a base, but it's a 108 inch long table.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and I tried to explain this to my uncles, like the challenges of the amount of leverage and the fact that this thing's going to tip over. So we're going to bolt it to his floor. And then we've got a custom steel frame to hold it to the stone pedestal. And then I did a torsion box for the top. So it's really lightweight, and it's veneered, but it sits the light fixture, the chandelier above it, or whatever you want to call it, is like hand-blown glass that hangs in different positions. It looks like raindrops. And so we're going to mimic the raindrops in the tabletop with brass inlay. So it's really wild. None of it was really my idea. He's super creative. He's a home builder and just does really cool stuff. So he's been kicking around all these ideas. It's been fun to work with him. And I don't know where we're going to end up with it, but it's right now. I've shot sealer on it. It's all been, you know, it's 90% of the way done. We got to figure out now where we want to place those brass circles, basically, that are going to mimic the drops coming down from the light fixture. And to be honest with you, I told this to him. I was like, man, I don't know how many people are going to walk into your dining room and translate all that, but he thinks it's going to be cool. So we'll see. I don't know where that'll land.
The customer is always right.
Yeah, exactly. I love those challenges. It's fun. I mean,
yeah, heck yeah.
Well, that's cool. So I assume the brass is going to be inlaid into the top.
Yeah. So where we're at now is he ordered just, I think it's 3/32 thick sheet of brass. And then I'm actually gonna CNC out. We're in between solid like 3-inch diameter brass circles or brass rings that are about a 1/2 inch wide and 3-inch in diameter. So we would inlay a ring, but the center would still be the wood, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Which I'm kind of hoping we go away from that, because
I would too. it's,
not only is it going to be hard, but I've got to, you know, anytime you work with a veneer,
yeah,
you got to be real careful when you're sliding it around, because if something gets underneath it, you scratch it. And I got a little chunk of nail under it, and I dragged it on the table, and I've got like a 2.5-inch long scratch. There's like not an easy fix for. So I wasn't worried about it, because I was like, well, we'll just throw a little raindrop right there and solve the problem. But now he's kind of kicking around the idea of doing these rings.
Oh, man.
It's fun.
Yeah. I imagine. Like, well, tell us a little bit about your custom furniture business. It's Andy Rawls Fine Texas Woodcraft. How did you get into business?
I started the business is about at the 10-year anniversary. So,
wow, cool.
Yeah. So I started in 2013. I started building furniture, and I can go through a lot of that in around 2003, 2004, I got serious about it. I was living in Waco, Texas around 2008, and this was right after I finished my just real short apprenticeship with Brian in Kentucky. I tried to start a chair shop in Waco, and that was in 2008 when everything kind of went haywire, and it was a total failure. And I, to be honest with you, I don't think from a craftsman standpoint, I was really ready for it. So from there, between that period in 2013, I met my wife, who's from Burney. So I moved from Waco to Burney, which is, you know, a 2.5 hours difference. And for one, Burney's a much prettier place. We're in the hill country. So yep. I'm really pumped to be here. And then after I moved down here, I started working for a custom door maker. So this guy was an older gentleman who had a small shop that's actually not far from my shop now. And he was a furniture maker and super talented one, but he found a niche in custom doors and had done really well with them. So we were building, you know, these entry doors for $1 million+ homes. And I think that I spent 3 years in that shop, and that really was what gave me, like, I saw how he operated and his confidence and his ability to just say yes and figure it out. I was real timid and before I came into a shop, and if people came to me for something, I'd be like, I don't think I can do that, you know. And I really learned a lot just seeing his ability to take the resources of the tools he had and figure out how to make stuff. So that 3 year, I kind of started that job. He was really, I kind of consider him a mentor of mine, because I started that job and was upfront with him and told him, you know, I want to do my own thing, but I want to work for you and learn. So he was willing to take me in and gave me those 3 years. And then after that, that's when I jumped in and started my business.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is super cool. Well, tell us a little bit about some of the furniture that you design and make. Is it, you do have some stuff that's on your website that you sell, but it sounds like you do also do a lot of custom work too.
Yeah. So I would say 85 to 90% is custom.
Mm-hmm.
I had a real big push to try to do more of a production setup with some of my own pieces, but I hit a wall with that, and just the difficulty of getting that set up and the money it takes to do it and marketing and all that. So I still sell those pieces and I enjoy building them, but most of it is custom. I would say probably 60% of our pieces are dining room tables. That's honestly probably the most commonly ordered piece of furniture from anyone. But we've done a lot of different stuff. Last year we did a whole set of furniture for a commercial project, which included a couple of waterfall tables, a big conference table. We got to do the cannon patterns and I'm drawing a blank on the carriage for the actual cannon for the Alamo. You know, and a lot of these unique projects have fallen in my lap from just people finding out about me through, you know, the YouTube and how that's kind of given me some exposure. But from a business standpoint, you know, it's just my doors are open to custom furniture. It's a 2-man shop. It's 1,800 square feet. We've got everything from hand tools, which is how I started furniture making, to a 5x5, you know, CNC. So it runs the whole spectrum. We take on anything that kind of fits a high-end custom furniture setting. So
yeah. Now you do have an apprentice, Robert, is that right?
Yeah, Robert. Yeah. He's been here almost a year and a half. And he's done a great job. He moved from Florida, and I don't even know if I'd label him an apprentice anymore. I think he's moved on from that role. There's been several projects in the last 3 or 4 months that I've been able to hand him the drawings and the plans for, and he can go. So he's been a great addition. There was a brief time before I hired Robert that I had an employee, and you know, anytime you guys know, like the dynamic from the one man shop is like the way it works. You know, it's individually based, but for me, when I build a piece of furniture in a one man shop, like I don't even have plans really. I kind of have a general basic idea of what I've presented to the client, but I'm just floating and going. It's kind of an organic process. And when you bring someone in, it's just totally unfair to them to operate that way, because obviously they're just like, whoa, what are we building here? So it changes a lot of the dynamic of how the shop flows and how it works, but it's a lot of fun. It's great to have another person in the shop to kick around ideas. And it's also awesome as a maker or a craftsman to share, to see someone else, you know, learn the trade and the craft and really enjoy it. Because that's the thing I love about Robert is, he's a lot like I was when I was first getting into it. You know, he loves to build furniture, and he really wants to be here. So it's fun.
Yeah. And plus, people don't think you're crazy because you're not talking to yourself. You're talking to Robert.
There it is.
That's right. There you go. Well, yeah. I do talk to myself even when Robert's in the shop. And I'm upset.
Well, that's great. That's absolutely fantastic. And I must say that your website is one of the best I've seen.
Man, I appreciate
out there.
That. Thank you.
It is really nice. It's really nice. All the video feed ins and stuff like that. It's fantastic.
I
read that
in last year. So that's awesome to hear, man. I appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so you're going to be at the Texas Woodworking Festival coming up. Tell us a little bit about what you're going to be doing there at the Texas Woodworking Festival.
My plans now are just to bring the business there and kind of promote it and to network with other woodworkers and other companies that are going to be there. I know Austin's probably really annoyed with me. He reached out with an email probably 2 weeks ago wanting me to do presentation of some kind, but I honestly think I'd rather just go and hang out and be there and you know, network with people and enjoy the show. So that's my game plan. I'm looking for, I have several good buddies that are going to be showing there and their exhibitors, and Frank's going to be teaching. Frank's another guy that I look up to as a mentor. So it's going to be a cool show. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Now you've been there every year, I think.
I was there the first year they did it, and then they shut it down on COVID. So yeah, I might have missed 1 year. I can't remember.
I think they had one last year, but I don't remember if you were there or not. I guess not.
I don't think I was. Yeah. So I'm excited to be there this year.
Yeah. Well, you picked a good one to miss because it was kind of hot and sweaty.
That doesn't faze me, man. I'm used to it.
Was it rainy or was it hot? I can't keep them straight.
Both. It's hot and rainy in Texas.
It's hot. Yeah. Because
it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. Because I met you at the first one that was in the bar. That was an interesting. It was in a brewery, and boy, we totally packed that place. It was kind of interesting.
I remember that one. And then I was at the one that was at the studio. I forget what studio it is, but the shared space. Yeah.
Yeah, where it rained. It just poured rain. Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess I've been to those two. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you missed the hot and sticky one, which wasn't too bad. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I think this.
So the plan is to drink and meet people. That's what you're saying.
Just hang out. Yeah.
Perfect.
I'm going to bring some merch and some stuff down and maybe sell some of that and just have fun. You know,
it'll be cool.
I think awesome. Robert's going to come down too. So he's looking forward to it.
Oh, fantastic. Cool. Yeah. Cool. Well, great. Well, I didn't want to bury the lead here, but I kind of did. But tell us a little bit about your work with the Canons. You've done some vintage Canons and one for the Alamo, correct?
Yeah. So I got an email from, I don't know, this was probably a couple of years ago, from the head guy at the Alamo, and it was like three sentences. It's like, hey, we're doing a Canon project at the Alamo. Would you be interested in building a carriage? And I was like, I just wrote back immediately, you want me to build a carriage for the Alamo? Yes, I'm in. And that was it. And I was, the bummer to that whole project is it was a fairly like large budget project, but I was so excited about it. Like I was just undercharging everything. I was like, I just want to do this. So it was fun. I mean, I got to, so basically what the Alamo was doing, the Alamo has done a lot of expansion in the last 2 years. And so there's a section called the Palisade Wall that they added in front of the Alamo, and that had a 3-pound cannon on it. And they're basically in the process of rebuilding all these replicas of all these cannons. And so I got to do the 3-pound cannon. I got to build the turn the blank for that. And then we shipped it up to a foundry. I wish I could remember the name of it. It's a very well-known foundry up in Ohio. I think that they're known for casting bells, but they've been in business for a long time. Hmm. They casted it. Then the actual cannon came back to my shop, which was probably the coolest week of my life because I had an actual brass cannon in the shop. I mean, I literally would walk up here at night and just look at it. I was like, this is awesome. You know? And then I'd also be frightened that I was going to mess it up. But we built the carriage, so we had to have the cannon in the shop to properly fit the trunnions, which are what mount in a carriage, into that carriage. So we also had Jason Thigpen from Texas Heritage. Mm-hmm. He did some blacksmith mm-hmm. work. Mm-hmm. He made the straps that hold that cannon on the carriage and a few other steel details on it. So yeah, it was super cool. It was a fun experience. I got to do a lot of research and learn about the process. I sometimes feel like I told Colby, who's the guy at the Alamo, like I don't feel adequate for this job because I like, you know, he originally wanted me to build one with the big carriage wheels. And I was like, man, I'm not your guy for that. Like that's, you need to find the right shop for that. And I think they did find like an actual carriage wheel maker, but they let me do this little one. So in the Battle of the Alamo, they actually had a lot of what they had was just repurposed from other spaces, other spots. Mm. And this was I'm probably not gonna get it right, but it was a ship carriage. So it was designed to be in a ship. Mm-hmm. So it's got little wheels and it rolls, four wheels, and it can roll and mount and shoot out the side of a ship. And so I somehow that made it into the Battle of the Alamo. And so that's the one I recreated because it was didn't require a whole lot of skills, specialty skills from a woodworking standpoint as far as wheel making. And then I got to do, there was a big 6-pounder that I got to make the blank for and a few other. So yeah, I mean, it was a fun project. It was cool. And I think the coolest part about it was getting to meet, you know, last time I was at the Alamo like a month ago and I ran into Colby and like, he's like, hey man, you want to go back into the vault and check out Santa Ana's rifle? And I'm like, yeah, like I just have the connection now. And so,
yeah,
it's so cool. To, like walk into the, like the museum and all these people are in there and I just get to go right into the back door. And like, it's this air conditioned room just full of relics from the Alamo that no one sees. And like, he's like, you want to hold Santa's rifle? And I'm like, yeah,
that's phenomenal. I mean, and not only are you known as that guy that they're going to call for the things that are coming in the future, but
yeah,
like having that access, that's yeah. awesome.
Yeah. You know what? When they first let me go, cause I first got to go into that vault to see someone make a carriage that I was making the same carriage, but this was an old one. So he wanted me to look at it and take measurements. And in the vault was a piece of furniture. And I was like, hey, man, what's up with this? It was like an old writing desk. He's like, oh, that's Sam Houston's desk. And I like immediately walked to it and started to touch it. He's like, whoa, 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 dude, you can't touch the desk. I'm like, okay, I'm sorry. Like, I want to see this.
Can I measure the desk?
Yeah. This is where the story's going. So I leave the vault. I go home, and it's just in my brain. And I text Colby that night, and I'm like, dude, I've got to build this desk. Like, you need to let me come measure it. And I even got to the point where I was like, I'm going to do a YouTube series. I'll build two of these desks. I'll donate one to the Alamo. We can auction it off or whatever, get funds. And I'm going to keep one for myself. And he was like, I'm in, man. That sounds awesome. And so, of course, when you're dealing with the state, there's all these, they had to get lawyers involved. And I had to like write up I'm a furniture maker. Oh, like, hey, why don't you write up the contract, explain what you're going to do. And they all freaked out. And they were like, no, we don't want you doing that. I'm like, I was frustrated, but my wife was actually, she was like, oh, that worked out good. Cause she was really annoyed that I was going to build a desk that probably was going to take 50 to 60 shop hours for free, but and build two of them. I was that excited. I was willing to do it.
Oh, that's super cool.
Yeah.
Anytime you get to touch history like that yeah, is exactly. That's incredible.
So are these cannons operational?
They are. The one we made, yeah. The little 3-pounder could be shot. I don't know if it ever will. It's actually kind of funny. I don't know the official name for these, but they make wooden plugs that go in the barrel to keep water from going in them. And he had me turn a few, and I turned one out of Osage, and I made the tolerance too tight, and it's like permanently stuck in there. He texts me constantly. He's like, "Hey, I cannot get that plug out of the barrel." I was like, "Man, you're gonna have to just drill that thing out. I'm sorry."
Is it a bung, like a barrel bung, kind of?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it.
Yeah, I don't know what the specific name is, but I made a really cool one, and I had some Osage, and like, I just made the tolerances too tight, and it swelled up. And I told him, I was like, "Well, I bet in the summer it'll heat up, and it'll come out of there." But he's like, "Man, we can't get it out." And so I was like, "Well, maybe one day we'll drill it out or something." But they're all, to go back to what you asked, they're all, I think most of them are shootable, and they have shot some of them, but it requires permission from the state and all that. So I mean, these things are crazy expensive. So
I mean, you're talking about pounds of projectile. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah. It was interesting. Go ahead, Mark.
Is it a state park or a national park?
I think the state runs the Alamo.
Yeah, it's state.
Yeah, it's not federal. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a state park.
I highly doubt Texas is going to hand the Alamo over to the federal.
yeah, that's not going to happen
anytime soon.
The state of Texas, like, I guess, probably the last legislative session, the one before that, they appropriated a lot of money for the Alamo to
read. Yeah, so they just built a whole new building behind it that they have several. If you ever go there, you'll see one of the big blanks I made. They didn't end up using it for the casting, so that it's on display there. And then they actually had a pecan tree in the main courtyard of the Alamo. It died, so that I've got some of that wood in my shop right now. And there's talk of, I did make knife scales for a Bowie knife. And there's a knife maker who's going to do that. And then there's a guitar company in Austin called Collins Guitars. And we've been kicking around the idea of making a guitar out of some of it. So I don't know. I don't really want to part ways with it. I'm kind of hoping they all forget about it, but I doubt they will.
Yeah. For anyone that ever goes to the San Antonio area, please visit the Alamo.
The Alamo.
Yeah, if you've never seen it, most visitors, when they go, "I thought it was bigger than that."
Yeah.
I have to say, my only experience from being from the Midwest is movies and some TV shows. Like, I know very little about the history of the Alamo, but I know it's a historic site, and it's definitely... It'd be something to visit if I'm ever in the area, for sure.
Yeah, it's a cool spot, man. And as San Antonio has grown, this is what the guys at the Alamo are telling me. They always find, like, they'll build a big building next to it, and as they excavate, they'll find like an old cannon down in the ground or something. So,
that's crazy.
Yeah. And a lot of these cannons, this is the reason they're recreating them, is because when Mexico took it over, they don't reuse the cannons because they're so hard to move. They'll just bust the trunnions off of it, or drive a nail in the touch hole, so you can't shoot. It just becomes useless.
Wow.
Yeah. So a lot of the cannons they have, that original, are just the trunnions were broken off.
Non-functional. Yeah.
Yeah. They won't work yet.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Well, moving from the Alamo to your shop. So tell us a little bit about your shop. That's one of the things that I think is kind of interesting about your YouTube videos, is seeing all the things that you have going on in your shop. So tell us a little bit about some of the machinery you have in there.
Yeah. So like I said, it's an 1800 square foot shop on my property. I got about 2.5 acres. So I'm about a 20 yard walk from my work every day, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got, I've got a couple old machines that people have seen on my YouTube. I've got the 36 inch Oliver, which coincidentally for the first time today threw a blade off of it when Robert was using it. And it was quite frightening.
I imagine.
I don't really know. Robert wasn't using it. It was just running. And
I'm terrified of that.
It was broken at the weld. So I don't know if it slipped off and then it just broke at the weakest point at the weld, or if it just snapped the weld, but it was curled up in that bottom compartment pretty bad. It took a while to get it out.
Had it been ticking?
I hadn't noticed any ticking.
When you cut? That's usually my sign to change the blade.
Yeah, it is an older blade. I mean, I get Woodmaster carbide tip. Like, I get the good blades on it, and I'll run them for, you know, 6 months or more. So it might have had something going on that.
But a 36-inch wheel, though.
Yeah.
How long is that blade?
100. It's 8 feet. Oh, I forget. I'd have to look. I forget. It's saved in my.
It's 100 some inches.
It's a lot.
No, it's more than that. Yeah.
It's not written on the outside of the saw.
No.
That's where mine is.
Yeah, that's where mine is too.
On the outside of the saw. We got a Tanaway. It's old Tanaway.
That must take forever to spin down too. Once you turn it off.
Yes. Well, it does. If it's on a variable speed, it slows it down. The V slows it down. Yeah.
That's so good.
Yeah, but with like today when it threw the blade, the top wheel spun for like 5 minutes. I didn't stop it with a stick. Oh man.
Jeez. Yeah, I'm sure it was a hell of a sound when it let loose.
It was loud. Yeah. I was working on my computer, and Robert, I felt bad for him. His heart was beating pretty hard. So the blade, I'm finding out now, the blade is 18 feet, 6 inches.
Oh, wow. My God.
Yeah. Eight feet was way. I was like, that's enough. Not 8 feet. It's longer than that.
That's like a 14-inch bandsaw right there.
Sheesh.
And I just bought another. So that bandsaw was made in October of 1925. And I don't know the backstory. I wish I knew the full backstory. I know it got shipped to a big machinery dealer in LA, which is a real common point for a lot of these machines to end up. They distributed a lot of machines back then. But at some point, it was in Ed Friedrich, I think I'm saying that right, shop in downtown San Antonio, because it had a brass tag on it with a number to, I guess, inventory the machine. Mm-hmm. And that tag is still on there. And his company started in late 1800s, and they made, I think they started off making custom billiard tables, and then they went into ice boxes. So I guess back in those days, they stored ice in wooden boxes that had negative spaces, right, for insulation, whatever.
Yeah, bunch of insulation.
Yeah. And then they've went into refrigeration or AC units, and that company still exists today, but they make like a wall unit or a mini split or something. It's weird. So, and I actually emailed them to try to figure out, and they're like, oh, we don't know what you're talking about. So, but outside of that, like I just bought another in the last year, another old Oliver. That's a 18 inch, and I'm still working on restoring that. And then I've been able to kind of work with the modern day Oliver machineries, which those are made in Taiwan in the same factory as like Powermatic. Mm-hmm. And I think Grizzly. And I have a jointer, a 20-inch planer. The jointer's a 16, and then their lathe, which is a really awesome lathe. It's one of the best machines from them that I've used. And then I have their 14-inch bandsaw. So, and then I have the saw stop table saw. So those are like the core woodworking machines. And then luckily, I do have a 43-inch wide belt for sanding tables. It's a single head.
That's nice.
Yeah, it's a great machine. And then we have an S4S, which is, same thing as a molder. I use it as an S4S, but I don't think it's been turned on in 3 months, and I'm actually thinking about selling it. So those are like the core machines, and then I have the CNC machine. So
what do you use your CNC for? Is it do you use it for furniture, or is it more for templates and that kind of thing?
I use it a lot for templates. I do use it for furniture. It is just a wide grab bag of use. I use it for a lot, like for instance, the golf ball cases. That's most parts on there are made on the CNC. So there's 10 shelves in the case. The shelves go into dados. So all the dados are cut in using the CNC. And then the shelves themselves are 3/4 inch thick. They each fit 10 golf balls. And the space where the golf ball sits is separated by 1/4 inch dados. So it gives each setting like a little space, if that makes sense.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is some people put plaques right there on that little spot in between the dados to label where the ball came from. So all those little 1/4 inch dados are cut on the CNC, and then the divot for the ball is cut on the CNC. So like that piece is, a lot of CNC, but it's a production piece.
Yeah.
And then like the sofa we're doing, I have to cut what I call a house mortise and tenon. So I've got a round part. I'm going to put a square or rectangular apron into that round part at a 2-degree angle. So I need to make a jig using router bushings that can cut both the the pocket that will hold the part in. So that instead of it shouldering, it shoulders inside the round part. I don't know if I'm making sense. And then inside of that is the tenon. Mm-hmm. So it's just an easy way to make a round part connect to a not round part, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's all. That whole jig is designed in Fusion 360 and knocked out on the CNC in the matter of like 10 minutes. I mean, the workflow is amazing. It's really cool. Whereas before that, you know, I would hand make that jig and spend 30 minutes to an hour, or even more, maybe figuring it out. So the backstory to that machine, I don't know if I really want to go into it. It was kind of a YouTube partnership that went bad. So I have a bit of a hard time with it because it is a cheaper China made CNC. Ideally I would buy, what I would love to have is an American made, like a Shop Saver of some kind, but you know, this company reached out to me and offered to send it for free. And I couldn't say no. And in hindsight, I wish that looking back, I would have been wiser and said no. It's not necessarily the fact that it's a bad machine. It definitely is. You can see the lower quality of it. And I've had some issues with it, but the relationship with the people was a nightmare. It didn't go well. So part of me wants to like spray paint the whole thing and take all the names off and like write my name on it or something, but that's another story.
Yeah. I think Matt Cremona just did that with a planer he has.
Oh yeah. He put a new motor on that one. Yeah.
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 I like Matt, man. He's cool. I like watching his videos.
He's good.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, tell us a little bit about your YouTube channel. You make long form videos, which is kind of interesting.
I got into YouTube by a complete accident. I mean, I have a buddy who is in Bernie, Texas, is home to several very large YouTube channels. And one of my good buddies has two like really large YouTube channels. And he was like, you got to start YouTube. I was like, man, I have no desire to be in front of a camera. It doesn't interest me. And he's like, you don't even have to say anything. I'll come to your shop. We'll film one video. Just don't talk. We'll just film what you're doing and post it. And he's like, if you can put up, you know, 8 to 10 videos, I'll plug you and I'll put you in and I'll give you a shout out. And so he came and I made a pair of Paul Sellers sawhorses for that. That was my first video. And then my fourth video, I took a piece of old longleaf pine and carved a spoon, which I don't even know if you call it carving. I carved the bowl and shaped out the rest of it. And that video, for some reason, YouTube latched onto it and it just took off. And that, I mean, if you look at my lifetime trajectory, it's like the first month of me starting my channel, it just is the highest peak of my viewers, of my views right there. You know,
that's not a bad way to go. I mean,
no, it was pretty awesome. And I often feel like I'll see guys. Yeah, go ahead.
You say you're just like fired right out of a gun and now you're just trucking along.
Well, there's good to it and there's bad because I like now, you know, that I like the channel has kind of leveled out, slowed down. And it's like, well, how do like what? Like it was so easy when I started. Like, why does it feel so difficult now? You know, it's like, what's going on? But I think I've morphed and changed my content some. And it's a lot of fun. It's so much work. I have a really hard time, to speak candidly, like managing my business and a YouTube channel. And I've teetered around with not doing it anymore, which I don't think I will. I think I'll keep doing it, but it's fun and I love reaching people and I love a lot of people will send me emails and say, hey man, you've inspired me to get into woodworking. And that to me makes it worth it. And it has helped kind of leverage my business. Obviously, you know, I've gotten these jobs from out of state and out of the country, but probably a lot of that is in part due to YouTube. So there's a lot of great benefits, but most people probably don't realize that I currently set my current situation is about 15 to 20 hours of on the bench woodworking. And then the rest of my week I'm in front of a computer. So, or meeting with clients. So, that's not why like I got into woodworking. So that sometimes is a tough pill to swallow, but I like to believe that, you know, if I put the right bricks into place, I can work through this phase and get back to being on the bench more.
Yep, that's the dream.
Yeah.
Yeah, you hope.
Yeah.
That's always my hope. That's always my hope. Once you get into this as a business, it's like, you're spending as much time on the computer as you are in the shop, if not more sometimes.
Yeah.
It starts it starts to get to you a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
Business, yeah, I mean, you have to run it, or it doesn't go. You know, it's and if you're doing a content business, you know, which is, you know, if you were a full-time YouTube person, you'd still only spend half your time making content, probably less. I've seen some studies where it's like 30% of your time is actually making the stuff.
Yeah.
And then the rest of it is marketing, sales, you know, like.
So true. Yeah.
YouTube is nice because it has a lot of discovery built in, but, you know, you still have to do marketing, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's been like, I try really hard with my channel to like really stay true to what I believe is craft and furniture making, and not, it's so easy as a YouTuber to want to just reach out for what you know is going to get views.
Yeah.
You know, like an epoxy pour or anything with a live edge or something like that. And I'm not like, I have nothing against people who do that, but like, I feel like I try to think back, what was my mindset when I was 24, 23, I'd just taken classes with Paul Sellers and Frank Straza and like gotten bitten by the bug. And I was like, I want to be a furniture maker. Like, I try to remember back to like what I really loved about it. And so I try to keep that going in everything I do. And that's the biggest challenge with YouTube, because there's a lot of money involved with it. And there's a lot of people who want, I've made a lot of mistakes, but like, you know, there's sponsors who want to, like, dude, I'll wake up in the morning sometimes and have three emails from some companies in China, like wanting me to sell their tools. And it's just like, it just gets kind of, it's so easy to like to reach out and just kind of, I don't know if sellout's not the right word, but like, it's, YouTube can quickly become this world of how can I monetize everything, you know?
Right.
I'm not saying I'm innocent of it. You know, I've had some companies that have reached out that I've sponsored my videos. And I'm like, man, I probably shouldn't have done that one. So, it can be hard to walk a straight path sometimes in my mind. That's my personal feeling of it.
Well, it is an enormous time investment.
Yeah.
And so it's really hard, especially like, you know, you said it drives sales from your business, but it's really hard to track that, you know, and it's not an ROI that you can just directly point at and say, unless you do an incredible job of like, you know, asking and recording all that stuff.
Yeah.
You can't say I spent 2000 hours on YouTube this year and it netted me $100,000 in project sales.
It's really hard
to do that. So,
yeah, I mean, there are occasions where people will say, oh, I saw you build this on YouTube, you know, can I order one? But, you know, like you said, like there's a lot of like ways that I acquire customers probably through YouTube that I don't even realize it. So,
right.
There's just no way knowing.
Yeah. Well, listeners, go out there and give Andy a follow on YouTube. It's Rawls on YouTube. So
I'm excited. I actually just, a good buddy of mine that I've known for a while, he's designed all my t-shirts, is come on. And literally starting this week, we're shooting the first video together tomorrow. He is going to help run the channel. So I'm hoping that stimulates some growth and more content. And, you know, I haven't put what the creative effort I've wanted to put into it in the last 12, 16 months, just because, you know, you're running a business and doing everything else. So I'm excited. I'm excited on the path forward. I think there's going to be some cool stuff coming out. I got a new series I'm starting tomorrow that we'll be posting up soon that I'm excited to share with everyone. It's going to be really cool. So.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So if you're listening to this, go follow him. Come on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Subscribe and like, and, you know, hit that notification button.
Oh boy.
So what's next for you?
Furniture wise, the backlog is not as heavy as I would like. We've probably got 9 to 10 pieces on the calendar. Some really cool ones. I've got a really cool King platform bed for a client in Austin that I designed. I this is going to be really cool. It's going to be hard to explain, but it's got two nightstands. So it's a live edge, big single slab headboard. I can show you guys that piece. You guys aren't looking, but that piece of walnut. That's the headboard. And then off the ends of that is two nightstands that are going to just float off that headboard. But I'm going to skeletonize the frame or the case of the nightstands and the dovetails. When you close the drawers, you'll still be able to see the dovetails in the drawer through the side of the frame. So it's going to have a Japanese feel to it. It's going to have all these little spindles on the side. and then you pull the drawer open, you'll see the side of the drawer moving in the case, and then you close it, and it'll close in a way that the dovetails both show through a gap in the spindle.
Now, this customer doesn't have kids, right?
I'm not worried about that, man.
Not my problem.
Yeah. Think about that. Yeah.
As long as the check clears, I don't care.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks for bringing that up, Mark. You're killing my.
Sorry.
No, it'll be all good.
Better you tell them than they tell you. You know what I mean? Like, you want to say, hey, keep the little ones away from this piece, but rather than them calling up and say, you broke my kid's fingers.
I'll just be like, man, they learned their lesson. It's going to be a cool one. I'm excited about it.
Well, that's fantastic. Let's move on to our fortnightly beer choices. So I'll start us off. I am just drinking Dos Equis of all things. So it's a nice light lager, and it's not bad, not bad. So Mark, what are you drinking?
Boulevard Wheat.
Boulevard nice. Wheat. Fantastic. Yeah,
some in-laws in from Wisconsin, and we tried to pick a beer that we thought everybody could enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we landed on. So they had a big old suitcase of it at the Hy-Vee. So we brought that home.
It's a good spring wheat, you know, just kind of like enjoying the little warm weather.
Yeah, it's a nice basic beer. Like it's not, you know, the best stuff out there, but it's, you know, it's better than Bud Light.
I don't want to.
Bud Light's had some interesting things in the press. That's not why I don't like Bud Light. The reason I'm not a big fan of the flavor of Bud Light. I've never drunk Bud
Correct.
Light.
Correct. I'm with you there.
But it's just something a little different than your average, you know, beer that's right there by the front door of the beer section. So
yeah.
Cool. What about you, Brian?
I'm drinking an IPA called Magic Words. It's from Grim Brewing, which is up in Brooklyn, New York. It's pretty good. It's not really hoppy at all. So it's definitely not a hazy, but it's the kind of beer that you could, you know, drink too many of and try and stand up and have it kind of haunt you. But it's new to me, but I would definitely drink it again. Sean, how are you?
Not heard about that one. Yeah. It's feeling like spring with all the fluctuating weather. So I noticed that Dogfish Head Sequench was back in the beer store, which is a nice little, they call it a session sour. But it's nice little citrusy kind of sour, which is a nice flavor on the tongue and on a it's cold today, but on a spring day.
Yep.
So it's a good one. So I mean, Dogfish Head doesn't make anything bad in my book, but go.
Could drink Dogfish 60. I could drink that.
Oh yeah, I forever. Saw 90. Their Grand Cru. I mean, there's a lot of them out right now. I mean, I'm in Ohio. I'm not exactly in Maryland, you know, like they do a lot more where they're local, but go ahead.
Is it spiking your glucose?
I don't know. I don't have a reader anymore.
Okay. But, okay.
Probably not. Cause it's more of a sour than anything.
Yeah.
It's got alcohol in it. It's kicking your glucose. It's
it probably is. It's lime juice. It's lime juice and black limes and sea salt. Like it's a sour. So
yeah.
It's not as sugary as some other things. Anyway, Andy, what about you? What you got?
I've got an IPA from Real Ale Brewing Company, which is local Texas, Blanco, Texas. I don't know, Kyle, if you've heard of them.
Yeah, I have. I've had some of their stuff. Yeah, it's pretty good.
Yeah. This is called the Access IPA. So, it's pretty tasty.
Cool.
Nice.
Cool.
Yeah. I like the IPAs because anytime I go to the brewery, I get the IPAs because I think it's more bang for my buck.
Exactly. I had a good one over the weekend, but I didn't write it down. It was as a hazy IPA from Hawaii. That was, yeah, kind of interesting.
There's so many now. I can't keep
track. I know. That's why. I was in the store today, and I was like, should I go this? I went Dos Equis. I haven't had that in a long time. I was looking for something nice light lager. But anyway,
for a while, the New England IPA was the hazy IPA, and now it's the everywhere IPA is a hazy IPA.
Exactly.
You know.
Well, with that, Andy, so where can folks find you on the interwebs?
So the website is just www.andyrawls.com. Instagram is @TexasWoodcraft, and then the YouTube is just Andy Rawls.
Fantastic.
Pretty simple.
pretty simple.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's, you know, I'm, you know, bravo that you got the andyrawls.com. That's that's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. I snagged that like middle of 2000s before I even started my business. I was like, I'm going to go ahead and snag this.
Nice.
Yeah.
I see your Instagram posts and it's, you know, AR_TX Woodcraft. Yeah. And I'm thinking Arkansas, Texas, like that's because it's just the next state down. So I was thinking it was, you know, it's like he lives on the borderland somewhere. And it's, no, it's not.
That's your initials. No, that's my initials.
that's how much I read the comments. Yeah. I never went to the bio, I guess.
It's all good.
It's all good. So Mark, where can folks find you?
I am at Mark Builds It on Instagram. I'm also on YouTube. It's at Join Effort, I think. Let me look that up. Sorry, guys.
Yeah, I think it's
at the Joint Effort.
Yep.
On YouTube. And if you heard about that class and you're interested in, you know, finding out when it gets announced, go to joineffort.net/MWA and subscribe to the newsletter, and you'll get announcements every week of my classes, other classes, free videos, all kinds of stuff. How about you, Ryan?
It's a good follow.
Yeah, great. Yeah. Instagram is the place for me at Obst Woodworks, and Obst is OBST. Kyle, how about you?
You can always find me on Instagram at Barton.Kyle or BB Custom Tools, bbcustomtools.com, or on YouTube under BB Custom Tools or Kyle Barton. Sean, what about yourself?
You can find me on most social medias as SeanW78, and I actually confirmed that with Twitter, as I hadn't been there recently, but it soon to be possibly defunct Twitter. I'm also there.
We'll see.
We shall see.
Dumpsterfire.com.
Dumpsterfire.com, indeed.
So do we have any reviews this week?
We do. We have a couple of reviews from the episodes with John Boise. Chef Moraes says, wow, so intriguing. Can't wait to listen. So Chef, you'll have to come back on and let us know what you thought now that you had a chance to listen. Mm-hmm. Robo Dwyer says, go John. Mesquite Tree Enterprises says they enjoyed the interview. Good luck in the future. And SSI_ says, this is great. So we appreciate all these comments. I'm assuming most of those came in through Instagram. But you can send us messages through Instagram. You can leave a review on iTunes or wherever you log in to listen to podcasts. But most of all, just keep the conversation going. That's why we're here. We want to hear from you.
And that just about wraps it up for this show. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on the podcatcher of your choice. Just search for the Modern Woodworkers Association. And while you're there, please leave us a review. You can follow us on Instagram at MWA_podcast. And if you'd like to support the podcast, go over to patreon.com/MWA podcast. But the best thing you can do is tell a friend. Word of mouth goes a long way in sharing our discussion.